So good evening, everyone. Many of you know that Nico and I have recently completed a long retreat. We were generously guided by two of our lamas in the Tibetan tradition in the mountains in Oregon. And so we spent the better part of these 3 years of COVID in retreat. And we still had contact, some, with the world. But most of the time we were in very simple kind of living. Just making your own fire and cooking on a gas Coleman camping stove and taking baths in the bathhouse. It's all very simple. So we didn't watch a lot of movies. But when we came out last year in June, I had two movies on my list that I wanted to see. And both by Lin-Manuel Miranda, the composer, musicals by such a genius, I find. And so I watched Encanto, and I watched In the Heights. Such great movies. But what I noticed after all this practice and this time away, of course, wow, the movies were amazing. And my heart was so in it. I mean, I was so in it with the abuela in Encanto. Like, so engaged and so sensitive to the music. Oh my gosh, tears and laughter and so caught in all the stories. It was like the sensitivity had gone way up. Maybe you feel some of this in retreat. And this is in some ways the fruition of practice that actually, you might even say that we get more reactive. In just in the way that we're more attuned, we're more sensitive to the machinations of the heart. And we watch it all day long. So with these movies, I was like, wow, I'm so sensitive. Always been sensitive to movies, but whew, this was much heightened. And in these months of being more out in the world and kind of curious about some of the longer lasting transformations that might have happened throughout those years, I'm very humbled to say that the sensitivity is still there. There's actually quite a lot of range in the heart, a lot of feeling, a lot of dukkha, a lot of joys. Like, the heart is even more tender. Maybe more reactive than before, feeling a lot. And juxtaposed right next to that is this kind of steadiness that we hear all about. The fruition of practice being one of this standing in the middle of things, this kind of poise and balance. That even though the heart has all of this feeling, more than ever, so sensitive, there's also right next to this, this kind of friendly, like, it's totally okay. It's okay, it's okay. You're really scared in this Disney movie. but it's okay. It's okay. And I've had a very busy few days, and I watch all the ups and downs and things, and there is this kind of okayness. An okayness that sort of like all the hot mess of the heart is totally okay. It's okay most of the time. And so that's what I want to talk about tonight, is this, in some ways, a paradoxical sense of steadiness even as the heart gets more and more attuned and resonant and sensitive to the world, to ourselves. So the Buddha had a lot of names for this beautiful quality of the heart-mind. I'll talk some about the translations, but mostly we hear about it as equanimity. The steadiness or stability. I've been thinking about this a lot today because it's so windy. Somebody said today, I love the wind. I was like, oh, I don't like the wind. Anybody love the wind? Anybody not like the wind? okay. Kind of, yeah, I was like, I am not going outside today. I do not like it. But this equanimity, sort of literally, is that kind of ability to stay unshaken amidst the wind. And I was really playing that with that some in the early morning sit, and then as we sat together in the morning, it's like the hall feels so quiet and so settled, and yet the winds are raging. You can hear the building, and it's all day long. But that's a little bit what equanimity is. It's like, oh, I've been sitting. I mean, might be windy inside you too, could be. But we've been sitting with some measure of steadiness all amidst these gales, the forceful pressure of the wind outside. And the Buddha even said that there's these eight worldly winds that we do get pushed around by. We get pushed around by gain and loss and pleasure and pain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. This is what pushes us around. It's a lot about what Rebecca's been saying. She talked all about greed and about aversion. We do. We get in the push-pull, push-pull. In some ways, our whole thing is around avoiding the unpleasant, going for the pleasant, these winds. So I'm going to find lots of different ways to talk about this, but the main point, maybe I'll just say this, and then we can be done with the talk, because the only thing I want to say tonight, the one thing, is that we develop equanimity, some steadiness amidst that push-pull, so that we can see clearly how things are. So we're not so distracted by the push and pull. We can see clearly how things are, reality. And through that, then, we develop a skillful response. Care, compassion, action, wisdom. How to be with things as they are. How to respond. How to be in the world. How to serve. So I love this word. Probably my favorite word for equanimity is tatra majjhatatta. Have you heard this? It's onomatopoeia. It is what it sounds like. So tatra majjhatatta. It's this tatra. The tata is the shaking, right? The world is shaking. The winds are blowing strong. And majja means in the middle, or a medium-sized being. Majjhima, right? Majja. So in the middle of all the shaking, we get to stand in the middle. Tatra majja tata. This unshakable deliverance of mind. That's really what we're doing here. So we don't tend to speak directly to this so much in the hall, but the literal winds outside are certainly blowing, aren't they? We live in a time of war. A lot of injustice. We're seeing colonialism and oppression firsthand. We're living in a time of climate change, warming. Temperatures are going up. The weather is strange. We lived through, still living through in some ways, a pandemic. There might be more to come. Time of loneliness and anxiety. And so I think this is really the question that we all sit with all the time is like, yeah, the Buddha talked about the first noble truth of dukkha, stress, unreliable suffering. Talk about that a lot in this hall. We can talk about equanimity, poise, standing steady in the shake. But it's pretty comfortable here, isn't it? It's like very beautiful, and we have even these nice cushions on the floor to sit on the wood. It's pretty warm, kind of. We have like space heaters we can turn on if we're not warm enough. The meals are gorgeous. I mean, it's pretty comfortable here. And I think it's a very uncomfortable paradox that we live with, those of us who are lucky enough, a very small percentage of humans, who live in this level of comfort all the time. And we hear about the world and we read, you know, we know this is all happening, but there's a kind of disconnect that, at least for me, I feel very uncomfortable and a little bit hypocritical all the time. It's like, okay, we like equanimity, sure. Easy for me to say with all this wind raging in the world. So we have to remind again and again, like, what are we doing here? What is this about? Is this a path of comfort? Is it about getting what we want? Is it even about thinking that we can solve unsolvable problems? What are we doing? And I come back again and again for myself because I have to keep remembering amidst that kind of disconnect and the discomfort. Pascal Eau Claire. Now, I learned this many years ago from Pascal. He says, we're learning to be with these aching and complex hearts so that we can go out and be with the aching and complex world. And it doesn't do anybody good if we're out in the world being blown all around. We don't even know how to work with the inner winds. So it's humbling. It's humbling. Yeah, we might need a really comfortable retreat center and a lot of simplicity to do this work. It's humbling again and again, and it's hard for us. Even in such a beautiful place, retreat is really hard. But there's a nobility if we remember, oh, this is in service too. Learning how to be like the mountain, right in the middle of all these gale forces. This is so important. And again, it might just be what we have to do. Pema Chodron, she says, you know, some of us meet our challenges with a raging bulldog. I think about those folks who are out on the front lines, you know, really living it. The others of us, we meet our challenge with a poodle. And sometimes we think about, like, okay, I'm just going to work with my poodles today. Just work with the Disney movie. That's okay. We have to love ourselves, right? Just meet us exactly where we're at. And that's where equanimity develops. Skillful means. And sometimes skillful means are not going outside in the wind. And that's okay. It's okay because all of that is in service to this trust and this growing capacity, a growing resiliency that can then, that grows slowly and gently, but also grows. So we turn to the wisdom of our elders. Ruth King is a wonderful visionary. Social justice teacher, writer. She says, equanimity can feel internally like a great mountain, with the mind solid and stable, undisturbed by the changing seasons. Or it can be like the ocean, with the mind vast, deep, and immeasurable, undisturbed by whatever swims, floats, or is housed in its waters. Equanimity can be like a strong fire, roaring, engulfing, and transmuting, undisturbed by whatever is thrown into it. Or like immense space, open, allowing, and receiving, undisturbed by the objects that arise and pass away. The Buddha said a similar thing. He compared our equanimity to these different elements in nature. Be like the earth, be like the water, like space. So as we develop this wider range of capacity, this steadiness, we start to come into alignment with truth. The second talk that I gave about the beauty of the Dhamma, we start to really align with things as they are, which gives us the capacity to actually see what's needed in any situation. A monk asked Yunmen, what are the teachings of a whole lifetime? And Yunmen said an appropriate response. So that's all that we're doing. That's what we're doing here. It's so important, actually. So equanimity, upekkha, it's found in so many lists, just like samadhi. It's found at the end of a lot of these lists. It's the last awakening factor. It's the fourth brahma-vihara. It's the final parami. It comes at the end of all these lists. Lady Sayadaw, kind of our great-grandpa in the lineage, he said that patience and equanimity are the two most important paramis. But often we hear about equanimity as the fruition. You know, it comes at the end. So it's after all of this other work, we kind of get the benefit then of a little more steadiness and more resiliency and capacity. So it's magapala. We just chanted this, magapala, path and fruition. We're in this path, and then the pala is equanimity, is this sense of gateway. Equanimity is the gateway then into the deathless. So often it comes kind of at the end, fruition. But this is, I'm reversing this actually, because what I want to say is that it's the beginning of our path. In order, we're all lay people, in order to live in the world, we need to start with this kind of resiliency. Right? It's so important to begin with that as we go out into the world, and then through clear seeing, compassionate action. So you've got tatramajatata, that's one word for equanimity. Upekkha is the other one we hear a lot. Bhikkhu Nalayo translates this as equipoise, this ability to look over, kind of see the whole picture. And before we talked about samadhi being kind of when we can look very small, the small things sometimes, right? Samadhi helps us kind of narrow in and look in. But equipoise, upekkha, helps us kind of widen out again, still with samadhi, but this wide, wide view takes in the course of history, it takes in perspective. It can kind of see all the angles of things. Pretty helpful when you're figuring out how to respond to the world. So my Tibetan teacher, Mingyur Rinpoche, he was one of the teachers who was supporting us so much in our retreat. And then I would have these difficulties, energy, and all kinds of difficult emotions come up in our retreat, and I would send him a WhatsApp voice message. And he was pretty good traveling all over the place. Within a few days, there would be a little one-minute message from Rinpoche. So dear, often, like, Tibetan grandma, like, are you getting enough protein? How's your sleep? That's so kind. But so when we came out in June, one of the first things we did was we went to see Rinpoche. We met with him, and he was so, so kind. You know, he sort of blessed us and said, thank you so much for doing long retreat. So felt so validating to be seen in this way. But then we sat down and we really asked him, you know, we're coming out into the world, and we're both teachers, and we want your advice, you know, how to live in this world, this broken, aching world, and how to serve, how do we fill this role as teachers and really human beings. And what he said was so personal. You know, he spoke very much from his own experience. He said, I have a very, very busy teaching schedule. And it's true, if you look at what he does, he just gets up early and all from morning until like midnight. He's teaching and recording videos and here and there meeting with students. So, so busy all year long. He says, I'm very busy. But he said to us, he said, my bodhicitta, my compassion, it keeps me very balanced. He said, I'm not tired. I don't get tired. And it's because I really have so much compassion, I care, and I think what I'm doing is meaningful, that it's okay. It's really okay. So it's a little bit of a high bar. I was like, easy for you to say. You get tired. But that's it. That's what I'm talking about. That's exactly it. It's like equanimity. When it's we're kind of outside that push and pull, it frees up all this energy then to know how to respond. And again, the humbling piece is that we don't stop caring, or we don't get less sensitive to the cries of the world. In fact, we get more so. We care more. We don't stop the storm. And I think I read this quote again before to you, but it seems to be a theme, this radical openness, and I just love it. It fits so well here. I'm going to read this again. This is from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. I think he's saying exactly what Mingyur Rinpoche was talking about. He says, the everyday practice is simply to develop a complete acceptance and openness to all situations and emotions and to all people, experiencing everything totally without mental reservations and blockages, so that one never withdraws or centralizes into oneself. This produces a tremendous energy, which is usually locked up in the process of mental evasion and a general running away from life experiences. So that's it. That's what Rebecca's been talking about. We're caught so much in this cycle of wanting and not wanting. It locks up our energy. But with Upekkha, more and more, we're creating space and energy and resource and availability. It's availability for our own hearts. We can accompany ourselves better. And then availability also for others. I love this story about Ajahn Sumedho. He talks about, I'm bringing this in because I know a lot of people in here are teachers and becoming teachers. And so he talks about his own journey. He was Ajahn Chah's disciple. Ajahn Chah was not such an easy teacher sometimes. And so his first Dharma talk experience, Ajahn Chah just said, go into the hall and give a talk. And he had to talk for quite a long time. So he talked about this. He had to talk for 3 hours. He had nothing prepared. And he said he had to sit there, and he didn't even remember what he talked about. He just like talked on and on. He had to sit there, and he said, I watched people fall asleep, and I watched people get up and leave the hall in the middle of the talk. And then he says at the end of this 3 hours, there were only a couple of polite old ladies sitting out there. He said it was such a wake up. It was such a, oh my gosh, immediate self-consciousness, pride, what a teaching, conceit, laziness, wanting to please, wanting to entertain. I mean, that is what's happening up here, you guys. Whatever it looks like, that's it. Teaching is such that practice, right? You know. There's so much here. And so what an opportunity to develop this equanimity. And that's what he says. It's like in teaching, he can see all of that self-consciousness, pride, all of the winds blowing, praise and blame for sure, fame and disrepute. He says all this comes up during talks. But then he goes back to the meditation. He says, more and more, I understand where this is coming from, this self-view, the suffering of it. Again, the suffering of the needing and wanting, selfing. And then one realizes this equanimity leading to emptiness. Like, what if this whole thing was okay? The whole display, wanting, not wanting, greed, pride, it's all just a display. So Upekkha as a Brahma Vihara, I'm going to spend some time talking about this one. It's been really seminal for me, so important. We started this month talking about metta, and I'm sure in your practice you've moved through periods of compassion and joy, equanimity coming as the last. They all interweave, they inform each other. In the Mahayana, Vajrayana, often equanimity is the first one. And so just to check it out as we're thinking about this, how is it that equanimity brings these others into balance? How is it that metta and compassion and joy inform equanimity? And I really love these images that Anallio uses. It kind of paints this picture of these different flavors. So metta is like the noonday sun, right? This basic friendliness that shines equally on everything, everyone. Compassion is like the sunset. We had a nice sunset this evening. It's like poignant. And it's all the more beautiful because the darkness is near. And then mudita, joy, is like the sunrise. All this birds are singing and the dew and it's all glittery joy. But upekkha, equanimity, is a different one. It's the full moon at night. It's the moonlight. We've got a waxing moon heading into full moon time. So it's a different quality of light. There's still light. It's beautiful, luminous kind of light. But it's quieter than the others. But the full moon, like metta, shines on everything. There's this bigness, this vastness to it. But it's a quiet, quiet kind of light. And if we're careful, slides into a near neighbor. And we hear about equanimity, it sounds so much like indifference and this kind of apathy or complacency. It's easy. Even writing this talk, I was like, how do we talk about equanimity in a way that it's not just indifferent? It's not removed or disconnected. It can sometimes feel that way. Often I think it comes mixed with some indifference. But that's why it needs the other ones. It needs this warmth, this deep sense of care. It needs a kind of delight, actually. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of the sensitivity. It's like our sensitivity increases, as does our upekkha, our standing like a mountain. So it's like we put it right next to our reactivity, or we wrap it up. We wrap our reactivity up in this upekkha, this kind of big embrace of it's okay. Now I've talked to some about parts work, all the reactions, all the voices, all the little ones around, okay, it's okay. You just scoop them up with your equanimity. We're all here together. We're all going to sit here together. It's the best approach with doubt. Doubt is very pervasive. Doubt is just so insistent. Sounds like wisdom. We've listened to it for years. So upekkha says, it's totally fine. No problem. Doubt is here. I don't care. You can sit right next to me. I'm going to keep practicing. I'm not really going to believe you, but it's totally fine. You can be here with me. It's all right. That's a deep kind of intimacy, actually. It's love. I'm just wrapping my arms around this doubt. Gotta love it. Gotta love it. It's poor doubt, right? Like Mara, we see Mara in the suttas a lot, like slinking away. He was defeated and he slouches away into the shadows. You gotta love him. Come on, Mara always fails. It's okay. You can sit right here. I'm just going to keep doing my practice. I'm not going to listen. Right. So it was many years ago, I was telling one of my dear friends, dear Dharma sisters, about some of my deeper dukkha. I've told, I think, some of you the story. I came to the path because I was suffering a lot in college around body image and lightweight crew team and getting weighed and just all this kind of incessant stuff around body and image. And my friend, who's a deep practitioner, she's a nun now. She was a therapist at the time, and she said, have you ever seen A Beautiful Mind? It's another movie. Remember this Beautiful Mind movie? It came out a long time ago. It's about John Nash, who was this famous mathematician, award-winning mathematician, who also had schizophrenia. And I hadn't seen the movie. I've never really been much of a moviegoer, but she was like, you have to come to my house, and we're going to sit down and we're going to watch this movie together. And so, and I had to travel there. She listened. She lived outside of D.C. So I traveled to her house. She's like, we're going to watch this movie. She sat me down. We watched the whole movie, A Beautiful Mind, together. And if you'll remember it, you might have been a while since you've seen it, but it's one of the very last scenes where John Nash, he's now a successful mathematician, professor, and he's lived most of his life with these imaginary people who for a long time he believed in, right? Sort of colleagues and friends and family, they're imaginary. But he's in his life, he's successful, and he looks over, he like glances to the side. All of his people are still there. he still sees them, and they're looking at him, you know? And he knows. It's like he's trained. He knows not to believe in them. So you see him glance to the side, and then he keeps walking. And that was her whole teaching to me. I still think about that all the time. It's like all those voices, they're still in me. Doubt, shame, all of it. But they're sort of just like your companion. You can kind of glance out of the corner of your eye and be like, okay, yeah, we're here. But we don't believe it. That's it. That's equanimity. So the traditional phrase for doing upekkha practice, if we're doing the phrases from the Visuddhimagga, the traditional one would be, I am the owner of my kamma. My happiness and unhappiness depend on my habits of mind and not on anybody else. So I resisted this phrase for a long time because it feels so kind of wordy and like a little bit cold. But when I did it in my longer Brahma Vihara retreat, I'd been doing lots and lots of metta and compassion and joy first. And then when I hit this phrase and I did it, I was like, oh my God, it doesn't matter what people think. It was like, for those of us who are people pleasers, I mean, it was such a big insight for me. It depends on my habits, not on anybody else. Doesn't matter. It was so empowering. It was so empowering. Like, oh yeah, I'm the owner of my kamma. There's this line in the morning chant that you're doing, the Imaya Damanu. Kamasaka. Remember? One of the last lines that means, may they be owners of their kamma. That line is pointing to this teaching that it's their, our only true possession, actually, is kamma. Of course, we don't possess our body or our mind, our chitta even, our consciousness. None of that is ours. Nobody owning it. But we do have intentions. We do guide our actions. So this deep responsibility, this is also the kind of engagement I'm talking about. It's like, how we show up really matters. I'm the owner of my kamma. So at the same time as I felt this great relief of like other people's opinions don't matter, I also had this sense of, oh, we sit up a little straighter. Like my happiness and unhappiness depend on me. I'm responsible for this. So what does that imply? I mean, it's why we hear so much about sila all the time. So important, these daily recollections. I'm the owner of my kamma, heir to my kamma. Right? I inherit my actions. I'm born from my actions. Majjhima Nikaya says, beings are the owners of their actions. Their actions are their friend, their refuge. Whatever acts they perform, good or bad, of those they will be the heirs. So we have deep agency. And that's also what upekkha can teach us, is we have a lot of agency when we're not so push and pull. Oof, so much choice. So much choice with what we do with our minds. What we believe in our minds. Don't believe the doubt. So another story from long retreat. This is maybe also my karma. I had aspired for years and years and years. When I was like 21, I met my lamas. They'd done 3-year retreat. I said, I want to do long retreat. I want to do 3-year retreat. So it took me a couple of decades to get in. But this had been a long time dream. And so finally in 2020, isn't that ironic? That's when we planned, like our retreat would start in March 2020. So when we started, we were living in a Tibetan temple in my hometown. And I found out some information about my first teachers. This is in a different tradition. Something about how they, something about the ethics, really way far back, like 20 years ago in my first pilgrimage with them, I found out stuff that I had not known for 20 years. It's pretty upsetting information about what had happened in our community, and these teachers were responsible for what had happened and potential harm. I mean, I never was harmed myself, but I could have been really easily. And when I found this information, oh my gosh. There I was about to embark finally on my 3-year retreat, and it was like the whole foundation was gone. And I was so mad and so disillusioned, really irate. Like, how could this happen? You know, I mean, we see it like over and over, and it was like all the stuff was coming out about the Sakyong and Shambhala. So we had heard all this news, but that was so close to home. That had been my home lineage. And to find out that years and years ago, there had been this transgression, never any reckoning, never any acknowledgement. It's like really, really deep anger. So there I was in retreat for years. And the irony, I remember being mad, but then also being mad, like, this is what I have to deal with in my retreat. Like, again and again, my mind state is just like raging, 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 and that's what it's going to be. So there's so much. It was like, at a certain point, maybe this was some equanimity, like, okay, this is what we're doing. This is what my mind is doing. And so this is what my retreat is going to be about. And it really did last kind of all throughout the whole time, and in different iterations. There was this deep reactivity and pain and well of sorrow and disappointment and like feeling of stuckness and just, yeah, having to heal. There was so much healing I had to do around like my young innocent self and what I believed and my naivete and a sense of being betrayed. So it was practice, but also like therapy and diamond approach and a lot of partner rain practice, and a lot of like working it and working it and working it and working it. And what I can say is that while, I mean, I wouldn't wish it on anyone, it was probably one of the most meaningful tangles, most meaningful journeys I've made in my practice, really. Maybe I told one of you this, like some lama, while I was in the middle of it, I was telling her the story and she said to me, you know, this is really important that if you're going to be a teacher, you have to know this kind of pain and this kind of disappointment and this kind of disillusionment. So like coming to respect my rage, coming to respect my sense of pain and being trespassed. But also now, looking back and really honoring all that process that I went through, I had to really honor all of the heart's machinations and all of the really righteous anger. And now what I can say is that, I mean, still in contact with those teachers, still don't really agree with them or what happened, but there is a lot of peace around the whole thing in my heart. There's a lot of sense of like, it's just this way. And it doesn't mean I'm not going to speak up about it and I'm not going to act a particular way. Like, I'm not going to really choose to teach in that lineage, maybe. But there is a lot of okayness a lot of the time. And even a sense of warmth and like humanity that I have. And then even as I wrote that, I was like, oh, and I'm still upset. It's both and. It's like we don't stop the storm. But there's a lot more grace. A lot more grace. I have a dear friend, Nolita Tsengiwe. She teaches sometimes at the retreat center. She's from South Africa. And we're inquiry partners. So once a month, we get on Zoom and we do this kind of practice out loud. It's from the Diamond Approach. And we kind of talk about whatever issue we're doing. And we practice together. We listen back and forth, take turns. And inevitably with Nolita, could be anything. There's like stuff going on with family or whatever's happening that's a difficulty in her life. She told me, by the way, she told me I could share this story, so blessings to Nolita. She's inevitably, after all of our inquiries, she comes out to the same conclusion. Every time, doesn't matter. Her conclusion is like, I can't change the situation, but I have so much agency over what I'm doing with my mind. And she just, every time she's like, that's so empowering. It's so empowering to know I can find peace, right, with even with all the stuff I don't like going on. And it's so funny, every time I find my mind like more caught in the story. Being like, well, babe, wait, that's not right. You know, I'm like, wait a minute. This is, I'd be scared too. And she's already come to this conclusion of like, but I have agency over my own mind, right? The sense of my happiness and unhappiness depend on my habits of mind. And she's in this fully empowered position. And it takes me just a beat to catch up with her. To be like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's right, it's Upeka. You can't do anything about it. It's good. Got to, like, hold our, you know, state of mind. And how empowering that is. It doesn't condone the bad actions. It's at the same time. That's the compassion piece. Like, we really care. And if we come from a place of equanimity, we're going to be so much more skillful in then the conversation we do have. Nolita is my equanimity teacher. So I always think about this parable. I didn't realize where it came from, and then I looked it up, and this is from Shantideva, actually. Shantideva is a wonderful Mahayana. Wrote this lovely book on the Paramis, The Way of the Bodhisattva. So Shantideva says this, where would I find enough leather to cover the entire surface of the earth? But with leather soles beneath my feet, it's as if the whole world has been covered. That's equanimity. That's what Nolita is doing again and again, just putting her shoes on. So we say the phrase for ourselves, I'm the owner of my karma, but then we do equanimity for others. In Brahma Vihara practice, you are the owner of your karma. Your happiness and unhappiness depend on your habits of mind and not on my wishes for you. So kind of a high bar for parents, I think. It's like advanced practice with family members. And again, it took me a long, long time to understand the wisdom and beauty of this phrase. And we can conceptually agree, sure, all beings, you know, they're the owners of their actions, they reap the fruits, whatever they sow, right? I'm not in charge of them. We can care deeply, but we can't act for them or love for them or choose for them. So we know that. But when we start doing this phrase, again, this was such a deep, transformative practice for me. It's like when I started to do these phrases, especially these phrases for my parents. I love my parents. I love you, Mom. I love you, Poppy. They listen to all my talks. I love them. But I did all these phrases for them. And what I started to see was actually, it was like the deepest kind of love. It was the deepest kind of love I could offer them. It was a respect and a dignity. They are making their own choices. I trust them to make their own choices. They're going to do that the better, way better than I could, even if I disagree with their choices. You're the owners of your karma. Your happiness and unhappiness depend on your habits of mind and not on my wishes for you. Yeah, again, really deep practice, but I think the phrase is helpful. And there's a deeper sense of intimacy when we offer that respect. We offer that respect to our loved ones. And again, this is a little bit like a superpower when we enter the world again. And I know some are going home somewhat soon. So can we hold the sense of healthy boundary? in all of our relationships. So you might have your own favorite equanimity phrase. Those are kind of the traditional ones if you're working at the categories, but other ones just in general that I've worked with over the years, just now is enough. Things have come to be this way. It's like this right now. May I rest in not knowing. May I find ease in stillness. And may I be equally near all things. I can post those on the board if you'd like them. So just a couple of strategies. We're coming to the end here, but just a couple of strategies around finding your poise right in the midst of things when you're finding the big push-pull. Joseph always talks about the pale blue dot, right? Carl Sagan's image of like when you reel way back out in space and Earth just is this pale blue dot in this picture. It's like big, big, big perspective, big time perspective. Right? Maybe this argument I just had, let's take perspective, this reactivity I'm having that someone isn't returning my email, pale blue dot perspective, more helpful. Even just going outside and looking at the stars at night or the moon can help do that upekkha. I think upekkha is a lot about listening, you know, learning how to slow down and listen. And trusting that even when we slow down and pause and listen, we might not immediately take action, but that pause is going to allow us for the clear seeing that we need. Patience, obviously, that's a big one. And then reflecting on impermanence in relationships, this is big. Yeah, how friends become enemies. Every meeting ends in separation. And when we trust the nature of change, especially in our relationship with ourselves, with others, it really helps us deepen in intimacy and be more honest, I think, with each other. Yeah. And then I've been talking with some of you. Seems to be a theme today. Realizing the difference between doubt and wisdom. And you'll feel it in your body. You know, doubt, that is a kind of reactivity. There's always a kind of contraction in your body. Wisdom, you'll feel relaxed. And we run a lot of doubt tapes. So really holding out to the light, recognizing if it has this undermining feel, it's probably not true. Probably not true. So I always think of this Elizabeth Bishop poem. I wanted to share it with you. This is just in nods to my English teacher days. I used to teach English literature and to high schoolers, and we would study iambic pentameter. Anybody remember iambic pentameter? And the villanelle. Do you remember the villanelle? It was a very unique form. And Elizabeth Bishop was really good at the villanelle. So this is her poem, One Art, which I think is very much about equanimity. Eight worldly winds. So One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seemed filled with the intent to be lost, that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. even losing you. The joking voice, a gesture I love. I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. It's both. She has both in there. She has a sense of, yeah, we lose, we lose. We practice losing farther and faster, we do. And even losing you, it's not too hard to master, but it looks like disaster. We have that sensitivity. We care, we really care. And upekkha is big enough to hold it. And then again, our beloved teacher, Mingyur Rinpoche, he also went on a 4-year retreat, wandering retreat. And he wrote a letter back to his students in the middle of it. He talks about it. He says, I've experienced both happiness and suffering. But the most important thing is a deep and heartfelt sense of certainty that's arisen in the depths of my being. No matter what happens, I know that the true nature of these experiences, their very essence, is that of timeless awareness and vast compassion. And this is what equanimity leads us to. So I want to just close with one more poem for you. greed type. Please all confess. You're like, are you done? Are you done? I have one more. This one's really good. Yeah. So just to bring it back, you know, I mean, we're talking about the world. We're talking about all of the grief. So one of my favorite poets these days is Ross Gay. Do you know Ross Gay? He's an African-American poet. He writes a lot about delight and about gardening. And also about injustice. So he wrote a poem called A Small Needful Fact. It's about Eric Garner. So just to remind you, Eric Garner is a 43-year-old African-American man who was killed in a chokehold on July 17th, 2014. He was killed on Staten Island by a police officer. So Ross Gay, A Small Needful Fact. A small needful fact is that Eric Garner worked for some time for the Parks and Rec. In this horticultural department, this means perhaps that with his very large hands, perhaps in all likelihood, he put gently into the earth some plants, which most likely some of them in all likelihood, continue to grow, continue to do what such plants do, like house and feed small and necessary creatures, like being pleasant to touch and smell, like converting sunlight into food, like making it easier for us to breathe. So the teachings of a whole lifetime are an appropriate response. And I think this retreat is worthwhile if that's what we're learning to do. Whether it's writing poetry like Ross Gay or serving our families or creating healthy boundaries or whatever it looks like for us. So we continue to be with our aching and complex hearts for this aching and complex world. And now we can just sit quietly together for a moment or two. can chant the sharing and blessings.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.